This is an ABC podcast.
I can't tell. Also coming up today, we're having a look at farm crime. It's widespread, sometimes has a devastating impact. We know it happens out there where it's hard to catch people in the act and the goods on offer are worth a lot. I wonder if your farm has been targeted. We regularly hear of fencing going missing, tools, sometimes even cattle duffing, which requires a bit of organisation. Well, a national survey currently underway is set to be the most comprehensive survey into farm crime in Australia, but more on that in just a second, because we're also looking at long-term weather forecasts from the Bureau of Meteorology. How helpful have you found them, if at all? Text in 0438 922 936. Love to hear from you on this topic. We've certainly heard from you before on this very thing. A lot of opinions out there. Plenty more on the show today as well, so strap in and join me until 1 p.m. I'm Meg Powell, and this is the Tasmanian Country Hour.
This week on Landline, fired up farmers question what happened to the El Nino.
We as farmers don't just use the weather to work out if we're going to take our coat to the park. It's actually financial for us.
And the big dreaming brothers behind the largest organically certified land parcel in the world.
My dream is to create an iconic Australian business, and I want to have impact that actually is seen around the world.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
It's 12:07 and this is the Tasmanian Country Hour. You're listening to Meg Powell bringing you the show today from Burnie, and we're kicking off with crime because the most comprehensive survey into farm crime in Australia has started to release some preliminary results, and it suggests farm thefts are up. But the survey conducted by the University of New England Centre for Rural Criminology needs more responses. Project lead Dr. Kyle Mulrooney says this survey is needed to help fill some big knowledge gaps when it comes to rural crime prevalence across the country.
The Centre for Rural Criminology captured the New South Wales Farm Crime Survey in 2021. But barring that, there's a little bit of data out of Victoria and really nothing for the rest of the country. We work fairly closely with the Rural Crime Prevention Team here in New South Wales. Through them and through our own research, we know that farm crime and rural crime in Australia is a national problem. It's not isolated to New South Wales and Victoria, not by a long shot. And so we wanted to try to understand this issue on a national level and really, really collect that important data that will help us address the issue in other states where we really have a dark figure and no clear understanding of the problem in these areas. But we know anecdotally, and we know from victim experiences covered in the media and addressed by the police, that it's a big issue for farmers all around Australia.
And how much longer of the study is left to go, and have you been getting enough responses so far?
Yeah, so the response rate has been absolutely fantastic. I think naturally so, the uptake has been in those larger states like New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, where we have a bit of information. So we're leaving the survey open a little bit longer in the hopes that we can collect more data out of other states, especially South Australia, Tasmania, Western Australia, Northern Territories, where we just don't have a historical picture. And so we want to make sure that we're capturing that with sufficient detail, specifically sufficient statistical detail. Our goal here is to understand farm crime at a national level, but also to understand it at an individual level, and that is at the individual level of the state. So we want to understand what does farm crime look like in South Australia. It's important that we understand these unique pictures so that we address it appropriately, so that we can empower policymakers, police, and other actors that engage with these issues, including the farmers themselves, with the information they need on the ground to actually address these issues.
As the survey is ongoing, you might not know yet, but would you suspect there are any major differences when it comes to farm crime between the states?
I think you'll find differences based upon a variety of variables. So what is farmed? What are the predominant farming industries? Of course, we'll highlight various aspects and various offences that are unique to certain areas. I mean, you find that even within states, where there's high levels of different types of farming. There'll be local characteristics that would very much shape that, proximity to major cities, different experiences across such a large country in terms of weather-related events like drought and these types of things that will definitely be attuned to when we're interpreting the data. But I have no doubt that what you will find is that farm crime is a problem across each and every state and amongst farmers there, that they're facing these issues, that they have been facing them for a long time. And so I think that will be an unfortunate but universal finding.
And are there any preliminary results you can share?
Out of the ones that we can sort of definitively, in terms of statistical representation, talk about, unfortunately, it looks like business as usual in those states. For instance, the New South Wales Farm Crime Survey in 2021, if we look at the New South Wales data for this national survey, of which we have a lot, we actually see elevations in victimization. So we see a greater number of farmers actually reporting victimization. So New South Wales Farm Crime Survey, around 81% reported experiencing victimization in their lifetime. That is, they were a victim of crime on their farm. And in this survey, we're looking at the higher 80s now. We see repeat victimizations quite high, so farmers experiencing crimes on numerous occasions across the lifetime. We've also looked at elevations of specific types of crimes in the last 2 years, particularly diesel theft and these types of issues, which again relate to changes in the economy, you know, wars the world over caused diesel prices to increase here, and you see a subsequent spike in these types of thefts. So right now it's all preliminary as we haven't closed the survey. So we'll have data, of course, still pouring in from New South Wales and elsewhere. But it's looking like what we hypothesized, that it would be an issue and you would see growth in other areas. And I mean, that aligns with a lot of the anecdotal data that we've been getting, a lot of the conversations with the police we've had or the media stories where you're seeing, particularly if we home in on stock theft, quite high level, sophisticated thefts of tens, hundreds, and sometimes thousands of livestock missing. And that sort of bearing out in the data, these types of experiences around the quintessential rural crime that is stock theft, but also, like I said, diesel theft, break and enter into properties, trespass, illegal hunting, all these issues once again appear very apparent and considerable for farmers across the country.
Some incredible numbers we're hearing there. Senior lecturer in criminology at the University of New England and co-director of the Centre for Rural Criminology, Dr. Kyle Mulrooney, speaking to Elsie Adamo. And I wonder what kind of crime you're seeing on your rural property. Are you having thieves break in? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Text in 0438 922 936. Jumping out of crime now and into trade, it's the middle of February and the live export trade to Indonesia remains in limbo, with the cattle industry still waiting for the Indonesian government to release import permits for 2024. And it's not just live exports. There's a variety of commodities, including Australian boxed beef and table grapes, which are also waiting for permits. For an update on what's going on, Matt Brand spoke to Troy Setter from the Consolidated Pastoral Company, which owns cattle stations across northern Australia and also some feedlots in Indonesia. He asked why Indonesia hadn't issued these permits yet.
Well, to be honest, Matt, we're not entirely sure. It's a very busy week in Indonesia this week. Next week is the presidential election. There's a lot of campaigning been going on in the last couple of weeks. And that has meant that ministers and senior staff are out in the field and out in the cities campaigning pretty hard. But to be honest, we're unsure on why the permits weren't released at the start of this year like normally happens.
So here we are in the middle of February and not a single animal has been exported to Indonesia so far this year. How damaging has this been for the northern cattle industry?
Look, I think for the northern cattle industry, we've been very lucky that there's been reasonably good rain in Queensland and the Northern Territory. For producers in Western Australia that haven't had as much rain in that Kimberley Pilbara region, I think it's certainly impacted some of those and causing some worry there. There's quite a few cattle, though, that are starting to build up around Darwin that are in yards or on properties that need to go. Particularly to allow feed to regrow for calves that will be weaned in first round. From an Indonesian side, and particularly for our business in Indonesia, we've got Ramadan starting in a couple of weeks. That's our really big beef sale time. And we had planned to take cattle, and so had many other importers in January to be ready to be able to supply that increased demand from Indonesian consumers during Ramadan. And that's starting to get concerning now.
And what impact does that have on the mum and dad consumers who go to the wet markets to buy beef during that Ramadan period?
But we've already seen an increase in price in wet markets for beef. It's not just Aussie live cattle that have been held up. It's boxed beef from Australia and a variety of countries. That's caused an increase in price. We've also seen some restrictions with some butchers just unable to secure supply. We've seen the chicken price go up dramatically as some of the feed inputs for chicken have been suspended or suspended, but not issued as well, and that's going to have a flow-on impact to everyday Indonesian consumers. We've also seen in our own business, we just don't have work for people to do, whether it's truck drivers unloading ships or abattoir workers processing cattle or people in our own feedlot to induct and process and look after the welfare of the animals. With less stock on feed, there's been a substantial drop in jobs available in Indonesia for workers and some in Australia as well. I know casual workers that our company would use around Darwin for preparing cattle for ships, truck drivers that would be loading ships or going to stations to pick cattle up and bring them up to the port, wharf workers and feed suppliers, they're all had pretty light pickings of work for the last 6 weeks, which is concerning for them. And I really, heart goes out to those people in Indonesia and in Australia who don't have work at the moment because of this.
Yeah, not one single cattle ship out of Darwin Port for the month of January. There's actually one in at port today, but I assume it's getting ready to send cattle to Vietnam or Malaysia.
Yes, yeah, that is correct.
Is this making news in Indonesia?
It's made a little bit of news in Indonesia, but not a lot. Indonesia is very focused on elections at the moment, and most of the media is around local election issues. Surprised me a little bit, there's been very little media around some of these food security and food inflation issues.
So how confident are you, Troy Setter, that this can be resolved soon, given there's the Indonesian presidential election in just a few days' time?
Look, I've spent a couple of days in Canberra this week engaging with our Minister of Agriculture and Minister of Trade and the Australian bureaucrats who, to be honest, have been excellent. They've been engaging well with their counterparts in Indonesia. Our embassies on both sides have been engaging really well. So I'm always optimistic that things could happen, but we are in the days prior to an election, so everyone's pretty busy on local issues, but I'm always hopeful that we might get a quick resolution and the release of permits. We have seen a couple of commodities, rice, sugar and corn, have their permits released. So we know that the system can release permits, Matt.
You've got a call later on this afternoon, is that right?
Yeah, we've got a industry hookup this afternoon with the ambassador in Indonesia as well as the senior trade negotiators and ag negotiation teams between Australia and Indonesia. And we're hopeful that there'll be some updates through that process, Matt.
Okay, so there'll be a lot of people with their fingers crossed, hey?
Lots of fingers crossed. And it's not just farmers and producers in Australia. It's shipping companies, logistics. Yeah, speaking to people in the supply chain, it's in both Indonesia and Australia that it's starting to cause some angst. And we've seen some restaurants in Indonesia make noise that they've run out of high-quality beef from both the US and Australia, Wagyu and USDA Prime-type product, and have not been able to have it on the menu, which is a real shame because everyone loves beef on their menu.
Troy Setter, Managing Director of the Consolidated Pastoral Company, there speaking to Matt Brand, talking about live trade export to Indonesia remaining in limbo, a couple of permits still waiting. It's about 20 past 12, and this next story I'd really love your thoughts on because I know you've got them out there. It's about long-term weather forecasts from the Bureau of Meteorology, and a livestock consultant is urging farmers to disregard those long-term forecasts when making decisions or they risk getting burnt again. Some farmers have even directed anger towards the Bureau of Meteorology after its forecast of hot and dry conditions prompted them to sell off livestock they hadn't after the wet start to the summer. Dr. Graham Lane from Agrivet Business Consulting in Hamilton, Victoria, says while that sell-off is understandable, long-term forecasts can't be relied on.
Well, we saw a lot of sell-off, particularly in New South Wales, where farmers had bad memories of the El Nino starting in 2019. Growers were selling a lot of stock at the time, more than usual, and certainly that seemed to be the supply, certainly in sale yard data, was tending to suggest there was a lot of stock coming on, and that depressed price. The problem with the El Nino watch and alert and declaration, but particularly, you know, they started talking about an El Nino watch from February, that there's no skill published in predicting El Nino events that early in the season. And this is not hindsight. There were several climate scientists at the time that warned that, we don't have great skill in predicting El Nino events that early in the season. Midwinter, yes, but not early in autumn, certainly not late summer.
So if there were those warnings from others out there, why was it, do you think, that there was such a focus and fixation on firstly that El Nino watch and then that declaration?
Oh, I believe there's a fair bit of credence in the Bureau's forecasts that have been published regularly, and the fact that most news services, the Bureau have good media units, and they make those forecasts very available, whereas a lone climate scientist saying a bit of caution about the accuracy of that forecast is battling a bit to get heard.
Given what you just said, what should individual farmers make of that, and how should they frame their long-term decision-making in relation to the long-term outlooks before them?
Well, the message to farmers I'd certainly provide would be to ignore the Bureau seasonal forecast, because the published skill level of them is very low.
Is it a difficult one, though, for livestock producers who've been through drought before? They want to get ahead of the next drought and sell off livestock they don't want to carry or try and carry through a drought. So they wanted to be proactive in that sense, but you're saying that They can't rely on the long-term forecasting information?
I'm definitely saying they can't rely on the long-term forecasting information. If you look at the published in comparisons with what they predict versus what actually happens, the skill level is very low. Unfortunately, the skill level needs to be high for farmers to make money out of these forecasts. So otherwise, they're just playing Russian roulette. By following these forecasts, they might as well play it without the forecasts. I mean, if for example, you need to have about a skill level of 35% in terms of accuracy with these forecasts to actually make meaningful financial decisions out of them. That skill level was calculated by Visard et al., and that paper was published some time ago, but still stands today, that you need to have good levels of accuracy of your forecast to be able to have confidence in making profitable decisions as a result of acting on the forecasts. Visard et al. Calculated the skill level at that time was about 2% for the Bureau for seasonal forecasts. 2%, and that's a long way from 35%. Since that time, they have changed their forecasting methodology slightly, and they have also got a brand new biggest supercomputer in the Southern Hemisphere. But the problem is, if you just look at last year, they forecast a low probability of achieving median rainfall in autumn, winter, and spring. That skill level is low still of these forecasts. Without having to do very clever statistics, it's clear that these forecasts are not working well.
What should both private forecasters, the Bureau, and also specifically the Bureau's new ag unit focus on in trying to provide farmer-specific forecasting information?
I think it's fine for them to do those forecasts and keep experimenting, but they should be published as experimental forecasts, not forecasts that people should make business decisions on. Further, they should publish what statistically is most likely to happen.
from your clients and the people you speak to, Graham, what's the sentiment out there toward the Bureau, toward long-term forecasts, and how will people's approach to those forecasts differ in the future after this, the experience of this spring and summer?
Sadly, people want to hear a forecast. They want to know what's going to happen. They don't like uncertainty, and I understand that. But, I mean, you know, that's the farming game. And I look forward to having accurate forecasts, but at the moment we don't have accurate forecasts. So for farmers who, you know, certainly like to hear a forecast, I think the replacement of that forecast with a more probabilistic approach would be a lot more helpful for them.
That was Dr. Graham Lane from Agrivet Business Consulting speaking with Angus Furley about long-term forecasts put out by the Bureau of Meteorology. Text in, tell me your experience with long-term forecasting and business planning. 0438 922 936. Text just in from before from John Grant in Lonnie, expressing concern that he hopes I've had enough sleep tonight. Heard a snippet on the radio last night. I think, yes, thank you for your concern. I'm feeling pretty well rested and had some coffee. Also expressing a bit of concern for the sheep and cows still on that live export ship off the Fremantle coast. We'll certainly keep across that, John. Thanks for your concern. Thanks for texting in. It's 12:27, and this Sunday is International Women and Girls in Science Day, where we celebrated women in STEM careers across the globe. Closer to home in Launceston are the Animal Health and Water Microbiology Laboratories that cover statewide testing for a range of pests and pathogens for livestock and aquatic species and wildlife. Claire Burberry dropped by the lab to meet some of the women who love working at the laboratory. She spoke with Connie Angelucci, Teresa Wilson and Melanie Leaf.
I've moved around quite a bit since I first started in science 30 years ago, worked in a lot of different fields of science, and just coincidence, I came to Launceston and was, you know, looking for work, and I was very lucky to get a job within the research group, and then I've learned on the job. That's how I've come to be working in vaccine research.
Did you study science at university?
Yes, I did. I started back in the 90s. I started science and did molecular biology as well back then when it was almost new. Worked around, I did a PhD as well.
And what was your topic?
Oh, so it was identifying the proteins in an insect that binds a particular bacterial toxin that is used by the cotton industry to control the insect, which is a pest of the cotton plant, the BT cotton. So the cotton plant has a bacterial toxin that's expressed and that controls, well, prevents the insect from eating the cotton plant. And part of my research was to identify the proteins that toxin binds to in the insect to understand how it works to kill the insect.
Connie, what would you say to women and girls that want to get into working in science?
You need to work hard and persist. Work hard and enjoy it. I think you can thrive in science.
Teresa, what about your journey into science? How did you end up working here at the lab?
A long time ago, I did a Bachelor of Science here in Launceston. I was working for Tasmanian Alkaloids. It was my first job. And I applied for an obscure little job here, developing culture media to support bacterial growth. And I really didn't think I'd get it, but amazingly I did. And I was working in what was called the Fish Health Unit here when it started in the very beginning. Yeah, and the salmon industry was a very small thing in those days. Yeah, so I just came straight from having a Bachelor of Science to getting a job here.
You now work in molecular biology. Did you need to do a whole lot of other training to get up to speed in this new technology?
Yeah, I was kind of lucky that one of the projects that I ended up doing through the Fish Health Unit was developing a selective enrichment culture medium. So basically to support particular targeted bacterial pathogens and trying to get rid of other bacteria that might also grow.
Did you always want to work in science?
I certainly was interested in nature and always liked picking up shells and turning things upside down and looking at things, so always very inquisitive. Actually, when I started university, I had no idea really. I actually auditioned to do music, and I was going to do music. For some reason, I don't know why, I chose science instead.
What about you, Mel? How did you end up here at the lab?
Initially, I moved from New Zealand to Tasmania to study aquaculture, specifically at the University of Tasmania, and I actually went on to complete my honours and PhD at UTAS, and then worked in research for a few years. After that, I kind of moved into the management stream, so laboratory management and then operations. And so I've been in this position here with the Animal Health Laboratory for about a year and a half. So, yeah.
So it sounds like there's a lot of different streams you can go into in science. You can go research, testing, management. The world's your oyster. What is it like working in a lab?
Oh, it's quite varied day to day. It's never sort of the same work. In research, it's quite frustrating at times when things don't work and you have to try and figure out why things haven't worked and improve on things. But that's part and parcel of why I like doing what I do. Most enjoyable thing is working in a lab.
Yeah, I like it, I think, particularly here in this laboratory, I think probably more than I would do in some of the other larger ones, because sometimes in science you can find yourself doing things that are probably quite repetitive depending on what you end up doing. But being in a smaller laboratory, actually we have the opportunity, I think, to see lots of different things and wear many hats. So I guess in the laboratory you do everything from cleaning the floor to reporting to clients and everything in between. And it makes your day varied.
I think we're all very much cut from the same cloth, almost. The work ethic is really high, which I find continually inspiring for me. All the staff, I think, have this such a high care factor. We know that, even though we're dealing with, a sample on a bench, there's always this recognition that there is an animal behind that, and the results that we're providing are basically going to be used to inform, the decisions for, the herd or a mob. So there's always that client that we're, it is at the forefront of our work.
It's Claire Burberry talking to Animal Health Laboratory specialists Connie Angelucci, Teresa Wilson and Melanie Leaf. This is the Tasmanian Country Hour. Coming up, we'll have a check on the weather, but not before we get some news headlines with Evan Wallace in Launceston.
Good afternoon, Meg. Former Labor Administrator Nick Sherry says the Tasmanian branch of the party is in a much better place than when he was called in to take over operations. In July 2022, after years of internal division, including a 2021 state election campaign marred by infighting, the party was placed into administration. Former Senators Mr. Sherry and Doug Cameron were appointed as administrators, but the party is now back under local control after a vote of the National Executive. The Australian Medical Association is calling for gender-affirming treatment to be urgently enhanced as it pushes back against political pressure over transgender patients. The peak body's new policy is pushing for doctors to have stronger protection and support, while warning high levels of discrimination are worsening health outcomes. Overseas, US Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin is back in hospital for an emergent bladder issue. The Pentagon says the White House has been informed and Mr. Austin has transferred his duties to his deputy. It comes less than a month after his secretive hospital stay sparked controversy. And in sport, Australian women's basketball coach Sandy Brondello has kept the door open for Lauren Jackson to play in her fifth Olympic Games in Paris. Jackson has said that she would be retiring for a second time from the Opals, despite being part of the squad that has successfully qualified for the Olympics. But Brondello says she hasn't given up on Jackson changing her mind. Meg, there'll be more news at 1.
Thanks, Evan. We'll chat to you then. See you later. Speaking of women, we better cross over to the Bureau of Meteorology now with, pardon me, Brooke Oakley, who's patiently waiting to tell us what's going on today in the weather. Hey, Brooke.
Good afternoon, Meg.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. And it is lovely out there today. There was a little bit of morning fog around this morning, which is unusual for with it being the middle of summer. But now it's mostly sunny across the state, and we're expecting the weather to remain fine and mostly sunny for the rest of the day. Also northwesterly winds with afternoon sea breezes in the east. Maximum minimum temperatures will remain well above average across the state today and tomorrow, particularly about inland parts where maximum temperatures will reach the low 30s. This is leading to low intensity heat wave conditions, but sea breezes about coastal areas, including around Hobart, will provide some respite to the heat, and it is currently only 22 degrees in Hobart. As we head into tomorrow, north to northwesterly winds will become fresh and gusty. It will be fine until showers develop about the north in the middle of the day and then extend statewide during the afternoon and evening. We are also expecting isolated thunderstorms about the northeast during the afternoon and evening, and the chance of an afternoon thunderstorm in the southeast. It'll be hot inland once again before the winds shift cooler westerly during the evening. With this hot weather and also windy conditions tomorrow, there are high fire dangers today right through until Wednesday, and the highest fire dangers will be tomorrow about the Midlands and the East Coast. The fire dangers do remain high on Wednesday because even though it will be cooler, it will still be very dry across the state. So on Wednesday, there'll be showers about the west and south, easing and contracting to the southwest during the morning and fine elsewhere, with west to southwesterly winds tending west to northwesterly in the evening. And then for the second half of the week, it'll be settled weather with temperatures starting to warm up after the cool day on Wednesday.
One cool day. Okay, that's fair enough. Are there any other warnings around, Brooke?
So for today, there are no warnings, but for tomorrow, there is a gale warning current for the upper east coast and the southeast coast, and a strong wind warning for all remaining coastal waters and the southwest lakes. If we look a little more closely at the coastal waters, today, west to northwesterly winds at 10 to 20 knots, tending southeasterly about the central east this afternoon. The swells in the west and south are southwesterly of 1.5 to 2.5 metres, and the wave rider buoy at Cape Sorrel is currently reading 1.9 metres. In the north, variable below 1 metre. And in the east, a northeasterly of 1 to 1.5 metres. And also a southerly around 1 metre, tending southwesterly 1 to 2 metres offshore in the south. Tomorrow, northeast to northwesterly winds starting out at 10 to 20 knots, but increasing to 20 to 30 knots during the afternoon, and then shifting westerly 20 to 30 knots in the evening. And the winds are reaching up to 35 knots about the southeast at night.
Brooke Oakley from the Bureau of Meteorology, I better let you enjoy the rest of this fine afternoon, I reckon.
Thank you. I hope you get to enjoy some of the sunshine too.
We'll see. Thank you. Chat to Brooke later. I'm sure to give some more weather updates for you now. For now, it's 12:39.
Are you a dream builder or a thrill seeker?
You need to be born without fear.
A daring traveller or a joy giver?
It's just intoxicating, this place.
You'll find all your kindred spirits together on ABC iView.
This is amazing!
With a bounty of programs like Joanna Lumley's Spice Trail Adventure, Grand Designs Transformations, Muster Dogs, and so much more.
Come on, puppies!
It's all there for you. Always free, always inspiring on ABC iView.
On air, on digital radio, the ABC Listen app and online. This is Meg Powell with the Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Jumping into global grain stores now, and the world is in between harvest, with southern hemisphere seasons crawling to a close and the north in winter hiatus. But global wheat and grain stores are looking healthy. Nick Carraha is the CEO at commodity analyst Lockstock Consulting. He says taking a worldwide wheat stock take has some complicating factors, but he reckons access shouldn't be a problem across global markets. Let me try that again. This is Nick Carraha now.
We're in the middle of two seasons at the moment, so we've pretty much got the southern hemisphere harvest in the bin.
And the Northern Hemisphere crop is largely dormant over the winter months. So we are straddling a couple of crop years here. But from a global perspective, the devil's in the detail. When you start looking at global stocks, we have to acknowledge that China carries a huge amount of those carryover inventories. So around between 52 and 54% of the global's carryover actually sits onshore China. And the significance of that is that they don't generally export wheat. So why we look at the headline numbers and things look pretty comfortable, we really have to drill into those numbers and look at what's actually available to the wider market. And that's why we tend to focus on the major exporters, which is a bunch of countries that generally produce more than they use. And as a result, that is the focus that we have when trying to decide whether we've got enough grain or not.
What are we actually talking about in terms of availability of time? Is it a matter of days or weeks or months?
Look, I think from a global balance sheet perspective, if you're a Southeast Asian consumer, for example, there's enough inventory going around. We've had a number of really big crops in Australia, but additionally, we've had some monster crops in Russia. In terms of availability, there isn't really a huge squeeze at the moment when you're trying to access grain. I think the significance of the dispute that we're seeing in Russia and the Ukraine really put into question, when you've got such a dominant supplier like Russia, how available that inventory is to the market. And I think leading into that dispute, people were really concerned about the ability to access that grain. But since then, Russia's been really efficient as they've ever been. They've set records in terms of their export program, and that's really kept a lid on global value.
And is there a global emergency store of grains in any way, shape or form?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think certain destinations have a strategic reserve policy. Even Russia does. But, you know, places like India, for example, will warehouse a percentage of their inventory that they grow every year. The government actually purchases that and then they release it in a method really to control domestic price, also supply, but they use it to make sure that A, their growers are looked after, but B, there's no food inflation, which is obviously a key issue for a lot of these emerging markets. So an interesting note on that is that the Indian reserves are as low as we've seen them in recent time, which had been a flag for a long while. There was a lot of conjecture around whether they'd actually become quite an importer. Remember, they produce 110 odd million tonnes of wheat, but there was, I guess, a period of time where people thought they may turn importer, which would have been strategically pretty supportive to global values, but they've managed to get through just based on what has been a pretty big rice crop.
Speaking of India, they are known for, during times of crop failures or during supply chain issues, such as during COVID, they do impose export bans on certain commodities, so certain types of grain, for example, that they consume domestically. Has it ever been the case, or could you ever see it being the case, that something similar could happen in Australia?
That we have export bans?
Yeah.
Look, I think if we look back over our history, where we've had some, you know, some shocking droughts across the country, and we've produced, you know, well under our averages, we haven't been in a situation where we have had to restrict exports. The efficiency of the market is pretty interesting. I think what we've seen, and as recently, if we go back into 2018-19 and 19-20, we actually produced 15 to 17 million tonnes nationally, which, yes, it's below the usual production, but is enough to satisfy our domestic consumption. The interesting part through those years is that we actually imported Canadian grain into the east coast of Australia while we were aggressively exporting out of WA. You know, we're a big country. We've got a good geographical hedge in terms of production, and we're able to move inventory around. But such is the nature and the efficiency of global markets that if we don't have enough grain, it's just a matter of finding that level that we can actually solve the problem by importing grain. So, yeah, I think it would be unlikely that we're actually circling the wagons and not letting any grain out of the country.
Lockstock Consulting CEO Nick Carraher speaking there with Fiona Broom. Jumping over to lamb prices now, because lamb prices are on the way back up after a surplus-led crash last spring. But some innovative technology is giving producers in New South Wales a boost in the volatile market. Landline reporter Sean Murphy went along to check it out.
At Oxton Park near Harden on the southwest slopes of New South Wales, they're weighing these weather lambs 6 months before they'll be ready for market. Keeping tabs on their progress is a good investment. At a time of low lamb prices, they'll fetch 80 cents a kilogram above the market average.
At 80 cents a kilo carcass weight, it can easily add up to $18-$20 a lamb for a good lamb. So, to put that on top of a carcass that might be 28-29 kilos, that's already a lamb that's already cut $40 worth of wool before he goes as well. It's really kind of sets our business up to be a little bit more immune to those ups and downs of the major markets.
At Gundagai Meat Processors in New South Wales, technology developed with industry partners is providing instant feedback to producers at the point of sale.
Yeah, so the scales are here, and the farmers are paid on weight, they're paid on lean meat yield, and they're also paid on intramuscular fat percentage.
Every carcass is probed to determine how much marbling or intramuscular fat is in the meat. They're then scanned to measure their lean meat yield percentage. The lamb is graded using an algorithm which also records animal health data. Only carcasses with a Gundagai lamb quality or GLQ score of 5 and above attract the 80 cents a kilogram premium. The company processes about 1 million sheep and lambs a year. About 25% goes to its premium GLQ brands. CEO Will Barton is hoping the incentive being paid for the best produce will lift the eating standard of everything processed here. But it's a work in progress.
So you've got not too much outside fat, high levels of marbling, so that'll eat particularly well. If I put that down and pick the next one up, it could have none, it could have heaps. And so that's the challenge we've got as an industry, is to be identifying this and then telling a farmer, well done, that's got good levels of marbling in it. It's not that obvious, but it's there.
The GLQ 5 Plus product has found markets in 22 countries, but its strongest sales are at home. Fine dining restaurants such as Encore at Sydney's Crown Complex are weekly customers. Head chef Alan Stewart blind-tasted lamb from a range of Australian suppliers before the restaurant opened just over 2 years ago. He says the Gundagai GLQ 5 Plus product was far superior and now goes into a signature dish.
By far, Gundagai was the most tastiest, the most flavoursome, the quality and also the marbling that they talk about in the lamb was far superior to everyone else.
There's nothing new or original about quality lamb brands being on the menus of high-end restaurants, but Gundagai lamb is broadening its market. The Australian burger chain Grilled is selling a GLQ 5 Plus lamb burger across its 170 Australian outlets.
We're using the delicious lamb shoulder, which most people would be putting on their barbecue and slow cooking. We're taking that high-end cut and we're putting it through our production facility and turning it into our delicious lamb patty.
The company has had a lamb burger on the menu for 20 years, but it's been seasonal and not always available until now.
Oh, there we go.
According to the company's strategic sourcing manager, Zoran Ristoff, it's all about scale.
We've always had that challenge in having a consistent product throughout the year in regards to lamb raw material. But with GLQ 5 Plus now, throughout the entire year, we've got a specification that is consistent and it gives us the ability to serve high-quality lamb all year round for our customers.
Cheers.
It represents perhaps the first sort of lamb brand to really scale and be accessible for Australians, which is exciting for us to get our name out there. And the key to the scale has been that we haven't, I guess, anchored the brand in a specific breed or a specific feed type. We haven't anchored it in any kind of a specific regime. What we've done is we've used science and technology innovation to actually identify the quality of the lambs post-processing.
It means that Merino lamb producers like Dan McDonnell avoid an industry-wide price cut imposed on Merino lambs and instead can earn a premium based on solid scientific data.
It's a buyer's market. There's no secret about that at the moment. So if any way you can add value to your operation, the better. Just as important as that is building a relationship with the people that you're sending your product to. Gundagai lamb, they pay for quality meat. It doesn't matter what name you put in front of it. It's whether it's with a crossbred or a second Dorset cross lamb or a first cross lamb or a merino lamb, they're paying for the quality of the meat. That's been a standout with us with Gundagai lamb.
Merino producer Dan McDonnell ending that report from Sean Murphy. And you can see more on that story on Landline. Head over to iView and look up the story. It's 12:51. Something very relaxing about that little lick. Heading back into Tassie now, though, did you know Tasmania is actually being digitally mapped over the next 10 years? The idea is to create a virtual reality version of Tasmania, which can be used to help prevent and respond to natural disasters, plan rescue missions, and decide where to put infrastructure. And farmers, thanks to a company called Agronomy, will soon be able to access digital twins of their individual farms. Stu Adam, Agronomy CEO, can explain what exactly that means.
A digital twin in our world is a really high-resolution 3D model of the entire farming system. So we're able to, in really fine detail, assess the height of every single tree and model the landscape to assess topography or establish topography in terms of a digital environment. And then from there, we can start to run analytics over, you know, where water is likely to move, where you might have erosion risk, and understand vegetation to be able to assess biodiversity and carbon within the environment. And then we also connect all of that information to satellite imagery services and sensors in the ground to get a dynamic view of what the farm is doing and deliver that in a really simple web interface that you can log into and move around in the farm in a virtual world and make decisions before committing to them in the real world.
It sounds a bit like Minecraft almost, like a little online virtual world. Am I on the right track there?
It's funny that you're the first person to bring up, the second person to bring up Minecraft in the last week. We have another client in another part of the world, and they're asking, can we convert this into a Minecraft game for our kids? So, yeah, it's not dissimilar. You know, there's digital twins are common in a lot of other industries. Think of a digital twin of a jet engine for planes, and they can assess, you know, what are the thresholds before the engine fails or, you know, how it performs in a particular scenario. It's exactly that sort of philosophy around.
So you could virtually dig a trench or something for your field to see if that will help with your water problems and model that in that software.
Yeah, that's a great example, is to be able to assess where water is likely to move to give a true or a more detailed understanding without having to, you know, walk through the paddock. As an example, just trying to bring all of that information that is now available into the hands of those that are making decisions, and then, you know, giving them the agency to have confidence in that decision.
Sounds very cool. Sounds quite useful. What has this got to do with Tasmania, Stu?
So the exciting part for us is that the challenge can often be in the available data that is good enough for us to be able to do the work that we do. So if you think of satellite imagery as more of an X-ray, if you like, sort of coarser resolution information that will tell you certain things about, you know, the crop, for example. What we've got here is, and the partnership we have with Virtual Tas is a statewide kind of MRI. So it's a laser scan of the entire state that's happening every single year for the next 10 years. And that just means that with that level of detail, we are unlocking that capability for every single farm.
It sounds huge. It sounds like it's really big scale. How are you actually collecting this? How are you doing these laser scans? Is it, a guy out in a field with a laser, or are we doing it from the sky?
From the sky. It's captured using piloted aircraft. And it's just a matter of designing a flight path. Think of, you know, a lawnmower pattern, just up and back, just constantly scanning the whole state. And it takes a few months to get through when there's challenges in terms of terrain and weather. It's not an easy lift, but the value proposition of the back end is great. And Virtual Tas and the program they've designed and the ability to partner with others like us just means that more people will get access to that data in a way that's useful to them.
Just how much of Tasmania are you going to cover? Is it just farms that we're talking here, or is it the whole thing?
Yeah, so the program that is being run is a statewide program, starting with the built environment. So where there is that infrastructure around power lines and those sorts of things are the kind of the main catalyst for capture. But the way that that program has been designed and the way that that priority area overlaps with the ag sector is perfect for us. So this is a thing where we have, you know, availability for all farmers. As the states and the capture program grows and, you know, captures more of the western part, the southwestern part of the state, you know, other opportunities around, you know, heritage sites will become real. Our focus at Agronomy is definitely to offer this to farmers.
Is there a privacy issue here scanning all of Tasmania?
No, there's nothing stopping someone from capturing that data. You know, there could be potentially perverse outcomes if the wrong people had, you know, wrong motivations and, you know, by aligning our focus with the our business model and data ownership to the National Farmers Federation Farm Data Code, we're really confident that that's a good way to help, you know, alleviate some of those concerns.
Agronomy CEO Stu Adam there talking to me about a 10-year project to digitally map all of Tasmania with lasers. Sounds kind of cool. I don't know. We'll see what it turns out like. In the end, it's about 12:57, which means it's time to check in with Joel Reinberger as to what's coming up on Afternoons. Joel, where are you?
I am at the absolutely delightful New Norfolk Pool because it's a public holiday in the south of the state, being Regatta Day.
Lucky.
And what better place to be when, you know, the weather is good and the holiday is on than at the local pool? And the New Norfolk Pool is a classic country town pool. Like, it's a lovely big pool with grass and shade around it and trees everywhere. Loads of people here today, and we're taking the opportunity to meet New Norfolk.
Beautiful. So, are you in the water? Are you broadcasting from the water?
No, I find that electrical equipment is incompatible with being in the pool at this point.
Fair point. Yes, I see.
But I have been in for the dip, and it's seriously the nicest temperature of any pool or water I've been in my entire time in Tasmania.
Oh,
it's just the most delightful, you know, cool but not too cool, not too warm water for splashing around with the kids. You would not find a better day for it than we've got today. We're going to meet some really fascinating people today. Now, we're going to meet a woman named Tamar Valkenia, who is Dutch and is this crazy adventurer. Like, does amazing stuff and has decided to settle in Molesworth up the road here. But she spends about 6 months of her year either with the Mongolian eagle hunters.
What?
Or
cool.
with the Bedouin in Jordan.
Wow.
Taking camels around the place. So she's this incredible adventurer. We've also been looking for a bit of live music to have here today. And what we've found is the Derwent Valley Concert Band's clarinet choir. So we're going to have a cluster of clarinets turn up and play a tune for us live on the radio today.
Ooh.
It's going to be a gorgeous day in New North.
That could be good. That could be bad. I don't know. We'll look forward to listening to you, Joel, this afternoon from 1:30.
Cheers, Meg.
See you then. And that's all we have for the Country Hour today. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow, 12 o'clock.
The ABC Listen app gives you ABC Radio the way you want it. So when the cricket's on, you can follow all the action. But if you want a different option, just choose one of your favourite programs instead. Download the free ABC.